True Crime Brewery contains disturbing content related to real-life crimes. Medical information is opinion based on facts of a crime and should not be interpreted as medical advice or treatment. Listener discretion is advised.
Why do you want to be executed?
Have to be. I will kill again.
No, I would do it again. I've been molesting kids nonstop since I was 13 years old, over half my life. Anything happened, I can guarantee I'd do it again, and sooner or later I would kill another child. I've done it before, and at the time I liked it.
Did your execution do any good?
I think it would. I think a few child molesters anyway are going to think twice before they do anything again.
How do you live with yourself daily?
Times it's not easy. You said there's times I think about what I've done. I think about some of the things the boys said before they died, and that's real hard to think about. But other times I just try to put everything out of my mind.
Do you look forward to dying?
In a way, yeah. I think it'd be a relief. I don't have to think about all these things anymore. And I know that's the only way I can guarantee I'm not going to hurt anybody else. You know, right now I'd sit here and say I don't want to, but I know it'll happen.
Welcome to True Crime Brewery. I'm Jill.
And I'm Dick. Before we start, I want to take a moment to tell you about This Sounds Serious, one of my favorite fictional podcast series. This Sounds Serious is a comedic homage to true crime storytelling. The show plays with the familiar styles, tones, and tropes of popular true crime podcasts and Netflix documentaries. The humor is smart, subtle, and integrated seamlessly into the plot lines of every season. Season 2 of This Sounds Serious is called Missing Melissa, and believe me when I say it's both gripping and hilarious. The show features top-notch voice acting and sound design. In fact, Season 1 was rated by Apple Podcasts as one of the best shows of 2018. To find out why, download Season 2 of This Sounds Serious wherever you get your podcasts.
Great, thanks, Dick. Child molester and killer Wesley Allen Dodd is remembered as one of the most evil men in modern history. What I find interesting about this case is how early in his life Dodd began to have his sick urges, and how his behavior progressed from exposing himself to murder virtually unchecked. After his murder convictions, Dodd revealed that he'd been molesting young children since the age of 13. In his final interviews, he admitted that there was no treatment for him, and if set free, he would definitely offend again. Then he declined an appeal, becoming the first person to be hanged in the United States since 1965. At the Quiet End today, Dr. Dick and I will go over the childhood and the crimes of this predator, as we try to make sense of how this kind of human being is constructed. Also, what can we do as a society to protect children? It's been a long-held belief that pedophiles are untreatable and must be kept away from our children. But is there a way to prevent pedophilia and sex abuse, or at the very least, make early diagnoses before anyone is hurt? So some big questions today, which I believe justifies a big beer. I hope you've brought one.
I did bring a big beer. It's the Rusty Nail from Fremont Brewing Company in Seattle. It's an oatmeal stout, and it's 14.5% alcohol by volume. So
Perfect. You
asked for a big beer, you got a big beer. The beer is black with a thick dark brown head and some nice lace, pretty looking beer, aroma of cinnamon, booze, and some roasted malt. Now the roasted malt's going to translate into some chocolate when you drink it. Cinnamon is there, a little bit of dark fruit, like some fig or something like that. There's some licorice and overriding everything is a nice bourbon influence.
There's a lot of stuff in there.
A lot of taste. Very nice beer.
Okay.
It's a thick, sticky, maybe on the sweet side beer. Definitely one to share.
Okay.
Which we will.
Well, let's open it up and pour it.
Okay.
Well, it smells fabulous. So I'm going to take my little snifter and work my way on down to the quiet end.
Got to do some meet and greet here.
Yeah. So you can start our discussion.
First, I think we should go over the life of Dodd and who his victims were. And then we maybe can have some discussion on the causes and the most recent research on pedophilia and crimes associated with pedophilia. Now, in many ways, these are the worst crimes and the most difficult to talk about, for sure. But we think it's important that we discuss them in our quest to prevent them from happening in the future.
Or at least reduce the amount of them in our own little way, I guess.
Yeah, I think that's more appropriate.
Yeah.
I don't have much hope to offer right now.
Well, no. I mean, when I talk about prevention, I talk about individually what can we each do in our lives to maybe prevent it from happening. And then in the big picture, how do we treat these people? That's a big question, which I know has been a tough one.
It's a very tough one.
Yeah.
We'll get to that.
Okay. Wesley Allen Dodd was born in Toppenish, Washington in 1961. He was the oldest child in his family. His parents, Jim and Carol Dodd, seemed like average working class people. Dodd's younger brother was born about a year after him, and they had a little sister who came along 2 years later.
So in 3 years, they have like three kids.
Yes.
Under the age of four.
So in 1964, his family moved to Kennewick, Washington, where Dodd attended grade school. And during those early years, Dodd's father worked mostly for dairies, making route deliveries, so a milkman. And his mom, while she was primarily a homemaker, worked as a cook for restaurants around town. So this is an average working class situation. Pretty normal for the 60s.
Definitely. And when asked about his childhood, Dodd said that he felt neglected in favor of his younger siblings. Parents would have violent fights, he said, which he and his siblings witnessed. But overall, he described the home he grew up in as fairly cold, with little affection, and no I love yous from either parent.
So it was age 11 when Dodd said that he became interested in younger boys. He experimented with a male cousin touching penises, and that's when he began looking at nude pictures. When he was 13, he began exposing himself to children in the neighborhood. He started by standing nude in his bedroom window while kids passed by on their way to school. After he got in trouble for doing that, he went out on his bike and he found other young children to flash. So over a two-month period of time when he was that age, he'd exposed himself to over 40 children.
This stuff of a little experimenting with the cousin, that's pretty normal stuff.
Yes, I agree.
For that age.
Mm-hmm.
However, the exposure is most certainly not
right
a normal event. And he did this to a lot of kids.
Yes, it gave him a thrill. That's why he did it.
So the police came to the Dodd house when he was 14 because there had been a report that he was exposing himself to children. But he wasn't punished. So he wasn't brought to court or anything like that.
Not this time, no.
And his parents did nothing?
No, his parents seemed like they were very distracted with their own lives and weren't the most attentive parents. His parents fought a lot, and they did end up getting divorced. His father, at least, seemed aware of his sexual deviance, but he avoided discussing it with his son or with the authorities. So also, no attempt was made yet to get him into counseling.
Well, no. So this is mid-70s, late-70s. So there's probably not too much that you can do.
Well, you can go to counseling and say, our son's flashing people. I mean, I would imagine the 60s, they knew it was abnormal and he should get counseling.
But they didn't know what to do about it. So the counseling would probably be at that time, don't do it.
Yeah, okay. I see what you're saying.
Then by the time he got to high school, Dodd had progressed to molestation. He started by molesting two younger cousins, and he also had anal sex with a male cousin. Then he began to babysit neighborhood children for some income, and while babysitting, he molested children as young as a year old.
Yeah, I can't even go there. That's horrific. He was first arrested when he was 15 for complaints of exposing himself to two girls who were 8 and 10 years old at the time. He wasn't prosecuted, but counseling was recommended to his parents. So he was finally taken to a counselor, but he only went sporadically and nothing improved with his behavior. as I suppose you had predicted.
Well, I would predict that anyway, but he didn't go very often. Whether he refused to go or his parents didn't have the time to take him or what, but if you're going to have any kind of success, you got to have regular counseling.
Yes, yep.
Which he didn't get.
Yeah, so without treatment or punishment, his behavior was continuing to escalate. And then after his father remarried, he molested his stepbrother and stepsister, who were both younger than he was. So it's a bad path.
It certainly is. Now, in 1981, when he was 20, he tried to abduct two little girls. Now, he got reported to the police, but for some unknown reason, he wasn't arrested.
Yeah, and there's been varying reports on that. Some of the things that I had read were that the parents didn't want to put their children through testifying, so they didn't follow through with the charges. So, no yeah. more punishment again.
Right. Plus, he's progressing.
Absolutely.
In his things.
Yeah, the abduction thing is pretty scary. That's another step.
Sure is.
Yeah, I think so.
Now, shortly after that, he enlisted in the Navy, and he got assigned to a base in Bangor, Washington. While in the service, he molested children on the base. He offered some boys $50 to go to a motel room with him, and that's what got him arrested. So he confessed, but again, remarkably, astoundingly to me, he wasn't charged with any crime.
Well, what would the crime be if the boys didn't go with you, but you offered? That must be a crime.
Solicitation.
Of a minor.
Sure.
Okay. So a short time later, Dodd exposed himself to a boy on the base, and he was discharged from the Navy. He spent less than 3 weeks in jail this time, and he had court-ordered counseling. Then in May of 1984, he was arrested again, this time for molesting a 10-year-old boy. So even though he clearly showed a pattern of disturbing and escalating behavior, he was given a suspended sentence and was once again set free to victimize children.
Just amazing.
Well, and if your child is one of these victims, I could just imagine that you would be enraged that he was put back out on the street.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, this is just holy cow.
And the laws have gotten, I don't know if I'd say better, but there are more laws to protect children, which we'll get into later. We'll have a discussion about that.
In 1982, he was arrested and went to jail for undressing a boy he had lured from a playground. So he pled guilty to this, but ended up serving only 30 days. And then he was released for mandatory counseling. We don't know how frequently he attended this counseling, but in any event, it was ineffective. Then he was allowed to move to Idaho to live with his father, and he attended an outpatient program there.
So Dodd was arrested again in 84, like I said, and that was for molesting a boy. He was sentenced to 10 years for lewd conduct with a minor, but he would actually serve just 4 months. So he's out in 4 months with just the condition that he gets psychiatric treatment. And this is actual molestation. This is more than exposing. So he's molesting children. He's trying to abduct children. This is all very serious, but very little punishment.
Yeah, and I know hindsight's so great, but geez, here's a guy who's been doing this stuff for years. He gets sentenced to 10 years and then gets released after 4 months. I mean, that's just a pittance.
It's terrible.
Yeah.
Especially since he had this history, which should have at least been seen as a psychiatric history.
You're right.
You know, if you're not going to put him in jail or prison, at least he should have been put somewhere for treatment. Not outpatient treatment that's voluntary.
No, even if he went voluntarily and regularly to treatment, he probably figured out ways to fake it.
Oh, he got really good at going through the motions and appearing to make progress in these counseling sessions. When his probation expired in 1988, he promptly quit therapy and went right back to molesting children.
Yeah, so we're back at square one.
Yes. Although he's getting worse, he began to plan to build a torture rack, and he began keeping a horrific diary. The diary held a collection of twisted desires to torture and kill little children. He planned out rapes and murders in disgusting detail.
So in 1989, Dodd decided to find a child to kill. He armed himself with a large knife on Labor Day weekend and went to David Douglas Park to look for victims. Later, he referred to this as a hunting trip.
Hunting for children.
Right. So the last day of summer vacation for most kids in the Pacific Northwest. School's starting. The heat and the holiday brought people outdoors to barbecue in the region's parks and recreational areas. And it also brought out lots of kids who were playing in the parks.
So according to Dodd, his sleepless nights began 2 days before Labor Day. He couldn't help himself from acting out his sick fantasies, and he didn't care about who he was going to hurt. Something in his mind was driving his actions. Something that the counseling had no success at all in curbing. In the diary he kept, he complained that he had been kept awake at night by his erection that wouldn't go away. He believed that killing a young boy was the only thing that was going to satisfy him. So he'd recently just moved to Vancouver from the Seattle area. But he didn't have any trouble finding that park. He noticed Davis Douglas Park while he was driving along a busy north-south road on the west side of the park. And he was moving some of his things from his dad's house into his apartment. And that's when he saw the sign and decided to go check it out.
Yeah, and the park was pretty convenient for him. It was only about a mile from his apartment.
Yeah.
So he had a good home base where he could wander around and do his thing.
Oh, yeah.
After he walked through the park and studied it, he drew himself a map. And on the map, he noted that the best area to find children was an area that ran east to west. East End was the most isolated, but it was still close enough to the more populous areas where children would be coming from.
So he actually packed a lunch to take with him to the park so he wouldn't have to go back home to eat. And he decided that he would be better off to take his victims away somewhere else to murder them. If he left the murdered children right there in the park, he decided, he might lose his hunting grounds. Police would start watching the park, and parents would become afraid to allow their children to go there alone. But he felt like if the kids just disappeared, he'd be free to return and pick up other victims. So he has a long-term plan to molest and kill children as a serial killer. He had the serial killer mentality.
Not just one.
No, not at all. At 1:15 p.m. that day, he saw two boys on their bikes, and these boys stopped along the trail, and Dodd walked past them to take a closer look. After passing by, he watched them from a distance for a couple of minutes and then walked back by them again. As he walked away from them the second time, they followed behind him for a short distance, and he became excited because he thought he'd finally found his perfect victims, even if these kids were a little older than he really wanted. But in the next instant, he turned to confront them and separate them if possible. But they did something unexpected. They turned off onto the fork of another trail and pedaled away from him without looking back. So we don't know if these kids got a bad feeling from him or they just happened to turn and go that way out of sheer luck.
Luck it is.
Yeah, because these kids came very close to being his victims.
Or certainly would have attempted, right?
Yes.
So then a couple hours later, a kid, little boy who's about 7, rode by on his bike, passed Dodd on the trail. And Dodd turned to run after him, but then he spotted the boy's father just a short distance away. So twice disappointed, but he didn't give up.
No. A few blocks away, in a middle-class home, two young boys were getting on their bicycles, which were parked near the front porch of their house. 10-year-old William Neer yelled to their father that they were going to look for lost golf balls. This was an almost daily event in which William, who everyone called Billy, and his brother Cole, who was 11, rode their bicycles to a nearby golf course where they hunted for balls that had gone astray. So they nearly always found the balls near the driving range and were paid for them by the golf course's manager. It was easy money, which they spent on candy, baseball cards, toys, the usual stuff.
Yeah, I did that when I was a kid. It's a good gig.
Yeah.
Just pick up golf balls and turn them back in. Kept me in baseball cards.
Yes, and you get some money for it. But unfortunately, now you have to be with a parent. You have to have an adult around.
Well, that's wise.
Yeah, but it's kind of sad that kids can't just go off and have adventures like they used to.
It is, but boy, it's a different world.
It is. It's absolutely necessary.
So just after 4 o'clock, the boys left home. They were happy, pretty full of energy. They hopped onto their matching BMX bikes and zoomed off down the street. So they got to the driving range, very excited, looking for balls. They did that for an hour and a half, and they found plenty. It got to be a little after six. They were tired and hungry. They figured, okay, let's collect our money and go home. So they wanted to arrive home in time for dinner. They took a well-known shortcut through David Douglas Park, along one of the secluded dirt bike paths. They were just about a half mile from their house.
But unknown to Billy and Cole, Wesley Allen Dodd had begun walking down the same trail just moments earlier. Dodd saw them and deliberately stood in the middle of the trail, forcing them to stop on their bikes. They were about the age he wanted, and there was no one else around, so he approached them and told them to get off their bikes. Now he was an adult, of course, and they were obedient kids. So they did what they were told. They got off their bikes and listened to him. Jeez. So either out of fear or a feeling that the stranger needed help, or if they were afraid of what he would do to them, they followed him down the path. As they walked along the trail, they passed two teenagers at one point, and Dodd warned them to keep quiet and not to talk to them. And kind of shocking to me, Billy and Cole obeyed him. I'm not sure what was going on there, because I would think most kids would take off.
Yeah, I think at this point, either they were afraid that if they say something, they'd get killed or hurt. Or they just didn't know what was going on.
Yeah.
But I can't believe that. I think they must have had an idea what was going to happen.
Well, I don't know. I mean, these are innocent kids. Maybe it just never occurred to them that an adult would want to hurt them like that.
Yeah.
You know?
I don't know, there's enough weird stuff going on that I would think they'd be worried about it.
Yeah, well, especially the fact that they didn't say anything when the teenagers came by.
Right.
Which would have seemed like an easy way out.
Yeah.
But they veered off the trail at one point, and following Dodd's instructions, they laid their bikes down just off the edge of the path, where they couldn't easily be seen. Dodd led them several yards up a hill into the trees and bushes, out of sight of the trail, in case someone walked or rode by. And he told the boys to stand back to back, tying their wrists together tightly. So the two brothers were bound together with shoelaces, and both boys were sexually abused and stabbed to death. Dodd fled the scene just minutes before a teenaged hiker found Billy's body and ran off to call the police.
So police arrived at the scene within minutes, along with paramedics from a nearby fire station. Billy was alive, but just barely. And the paramedics felt there was a tiny chance that he could be saved, but it would take too long to drive him to the hospital, so they called a life flight helicopter just across the river in Portland, Oregon. They knew the Portland hospitals were better equipped to deal with trauma victims than Vancouver's hospitals. So the paramedics did what they could to stabilize Billy, and then he was transported to Fort Vancouver High School and was picked up by the helicopter.
So they haven't even found Cole. Billy was barely breathing as a nurse and a paramedic treated his wounds during the short flight to Portland, but he died in transport. His injuries were too extensive and he'd lost too much blood. So Billy, a kid, of course, had no ID, and he was pronounced dead on arrival at the hospital at 7:37 p.m. that night, and he was listed as a junior Doe. But Mom, Claire Neer, at this point is worried sick about her sons, Billy and Cole, because they haven't returned home for dinner. And she hadn't heard the news about the child found at David Douglas Park. A few minutes before 8 p.m., the Neers began a street-by-street search of the neighborhood and areas on the east side of the park. After finding no trace of the boys or their bikes, they were more alarmed than ever. Panic is starting to set in for this mom and dad.
Wouldn't you think? I mean, geez, horrible.
Horrible.
So Claire Neer called the Vancouver Police Department around 9 o'clock that evening, and she reported both Billy and Cole as missing. So when word of the phone call about two missing boys got to the detectives investigating the David Douglas Park homicide, they realized that there might be another body that they hadn't found yet. A dozen or so searches made up of police officers, firefighters, and members of the Silver Star Search and Rescue Team remained at the scene where Billy's body had been found. As they searched the park, detectives worked to determine if Junior Doe was one of the missing Neer brothers.
By now aware of the circumstances of these missing boys, two detectives went to the near home. Shortly after being invited inside by Claire, they noticed a computer printout picture of the two boys that she had on a table. One of the detectives immediately thought that he recognized one of the boys as being the victim they'd found in the park. So that really made his heart sink. But before they could tell the Nears about this boy, they had to make sure that it was their son so they didn't give him false information. So meanwhile at the park, a group of searchers walked carefully along the trails with flashlights, looking for the other victim. It was slow going in the dark, but the searchers found the two children's BMX bikes near the trail, about 45 yards south from where the hiker had found Billy. Both bikes fit the description given to police by Claire Near of her boys' bikes.
And then later that night, about 2 in the morning, a volunteer from the Silver Star Search and Rescue Team found Cole. He was dead at the scene. His body was lying among heavy brush about 25 yards east of where the bicycles were found, right where Dot had left him. And like Billy, he had been stabbed in the chest and abdomen. Also like Billy, Cole had defensive wounds on his hands and legs, so both boys had attempted to fight off their attacker. Later that morning, there was no doubt about the boys' identities. Using photographs provided by their mother, detectives confirmed that the victims were Billy and Cole Near.
And of course, the hiker who found Billy, his name was Danny Miller, he was first considered a suspect. And they did, of course, eventually eliminate him as a suspect, but it caused Miller a lot of problems. Finding that body changed him.
Forever.
Yeah, he ended up suffering from depression, nightmares, and paranoia. He had difficulty finding and keeping a job, and was eventually diagnosed as suffering from post-traumatic stress syndrome because of the experience. So he ended up spending his life on Social Security disability benefits because he just could not deal with it.
Well, I can't imagine.
I can't either.
Finding a little kid brutally murdered like that.
Yeah, how would you ever get that image out of your mind?
I don't think you would.
No, I think you're right.
So in the aftermath of the murders, the residents of the neighborhood were obviously very tense.
Yes.
One group of parents positioned themselves like guards about 50 yards apart and lined the paths that ran along the routes that many school children normally took to and from school. And other parents, even those who lived only a few blocks from the schools and would typically allow their kids to walk or ride their bikes to and from school, began driving their kids instead.
Well, police and parents weren't the only ones who were jumpy in the aftermath of the Near murders. The Vancouver School District initiated a new set of standards to ensure child safety, and they increased adult supervision on playgrounds, also at student crossing zones. You know, the people with the orange vest that help the kids cross the street. They had more of those. And they sent letters home cautioning parents to not allow their children to take routes through secluded or wooded areas to and from school, and to always walk or ride their bikes in groups, not to be alone. But the thing here is the Near brothers were together, which I would have felt as a parent would make them safer. But that really doesn't seem to be true.
No, one or two, I don't think it makes that much difference.
Well, they're 10, 11 years old and they're together. That would make me feel a little bit like, yeah, they'll probably be okay.
It's still not that difficult to subdue two kids as one kid. Now, 3, 4, 5 kids, you're not going to get all of them.
Yeah. But if you threaten them, I mean, usually kids will listen.
Yeah, I guess. Like what? I have a gun. I'll shoot you.
Yeah, like with Jacob Wetterling. I think there were 3 boys on their bikes, and he threatened them with a gun to drop their bikes in the ditch, and 2 of them took off, and he took Jacob.
Yeah.
So people realized that every parent's worst nightmare had become a reality in their area, and it was terrifying, not to mention how upsetting it was.
Terribly. So Wesley Allen Dodd, meanwhile, was already making plans for his future victims. After killing Billy and Cole Near, he created a scrapbook with newspaper clippings about the murders. Then on October 29th, he drove to Portland, Oregon, where he saw 4-year-old Lee Izzelli and her 9-year-old brother at a park. And his 9-year-old brother at a park. Lee was playing alone on a slide, and Dodd abducted him. And he managed to get the boy to his apartment, where he kept him overnight, molesting him and taking pictures. Then the next morning, Dodd strangled Lee and hung him in a closet. And then he eventually stuffed the boy's body into trash bags and threw it in the bushes near the Vancouver Lake. He burned Lee's clothing, but kept his underwear as a souvenir. Now, Lee's body was found the next day. But see, he's already, look what he's done. He abducts these first two kids, these brothers.
Yeah.
And pretty much quickly rapes them and kills them. This poor little 4-year-old he takes to his apartment, kept him overnight, doing who knows what unspeakable things.
Things we're not even going to think about.
And then killed him, and then stuffed the kid's body in trash bags and threw it away.
Yeah, it was a fast escalation, right?
Sure was.
And you just wonder where he would go from there. As the police searched for a child killer, Dodd mostly stayed in his apartment and made plans for his future crimes. A couple of weeks later, on November 13th, he attempted to abduct a 6-year-old boy from a movie theater restroom. This was scary. Dodd sat in the back of a theater and followed the boy when he went out to use the restroom. And as the boy exited a stall, Dodd was the only other person in there. He picked the boy up, hoisting him over his shoulder, and this boy screamed and fought as Dodd walked toward the bathroom door. Dodd released his grip enough to hit the boy with his free hand, and then he punched him in the chest hard, hoping to knock the air out of him and get him to be quiet while he took him out. So then he tossed him back over his shoulder. But Kathy Asher, one of the theater's co-owners, was standing at the concession stand in the lobby. She was talking to some other employees, and they could hear a child screaming in the restroom. So she asked a male employee to go in and see what was happening. But the little boy screamed at the top of his lungs and was kicking violently at Dodd. But Dodd tried to act like he was his parent, his father, and he just said, "Calm down, son, calm down." Then he walked past the employee and through the doors that led out to the lobby. At first, the employee thought that Dodd was the boy's father, but he continued to scream, and Dodd, when he noticed that everyone was starting to watch, ran out the front door with the boy. This is when the little boy started yelling, "Please help me. I don't know him. He's trying to hurt me." So smart kid.
Good for him.
Yeah. By the time theater employees reached the outside, they saw the man that they would later be able to identify as Dodd, running with the boy west down 4th Avenue and disappearing as he turned the corner. They followed, and to their relief, the small blonde boy came running down the sidewalk just as they reached the corner. Dodd had been seen dropping the boy and getting into a yellow Pinto station wagon. And after he got inside the car, he was seen driving off and heading north.
So the boyfriend of the little kid's mother followed Dodd's Pinto. And it turns out the Pinto broke down, and this boyfriend approached Dodd and offered to help. Now, Dodd didn't know who this guy was, so he says, "Sure, thank you for helping." Now, the boyfriend was much bigger than Dodd, so he was able to subdue him, put him in a headlock, and bring him back to the theater, and police were called.
So this guy was a hero.
Well, so is that kid.
Absolutely. Because this puts a stop to it. Something which I think a lot more people could have been killed. Many more children could have been hurt and killed by this guy.
Well, you know it. He was planning on doing a lot of stuff.
He was. The local police contacted the Portland Police Task Force because they were investigating the murder of Lee Izzelli. Dodd was brought into the station and interrogated over the course of 3 days, and he eventually confessed to all 3 murders, and then they were able to search his apartment. When the search of the apartment was done, police found a homemade torture rack, they found the scrapbook, they found the diary, and they found a photo album with pictures of the poor murdered 4-year-old, Lee Izzelli. They also found the boy's underwear and store catalogs with underwear ads.
First, nobody could believe that Wesley Allen Dodd had been deranged since his childhood. But information from police agencies and psychological reports that confirmed an escalation of his behavior. Much of what came out showed a detailed, extensive history of sexual contact with children, some of which beginning while Dodd was still a child himself. So by his own account, Dodd said he evolved slowly into a monster starting about age 13, and he gradually progressed to the point where by age 25, he began having thoughts of rape and murder.
Well, he also said that by the time he was 10 years old, he heard his parents arguing nearly every night while he listened from his bedroom. So he described his parents' relationship as lousy and said that they fought all the time. They were vicious and they fought over dumb things. He said that although the family went camping and picnicking together, his parents argued constantly. But it's really important to note that following the murders and Dodd's arrest, his siblings refuted these statements about there being no love in the family. So that's probably not even true. So I really don't see anything in his history that would make him this way. It seems more genetic to me.
Yes, I think so. I mean, if his siblings, and the parents did divorce.
Yeah, but half of the parents divorce.
That's true.
So that's really not an excuse at all.
You're right.
But Dodd had reported to a therapist that he felt relieved when his mother and father separated because he'd known that they would eventually get a divorce and he thought everyone would be happier. Their lives, he said, were really marked by frequent moves and constant problems between his parents, though. Still, the siblings say not true. The parents got a divorce, but it really wasn't that bad. Pretty average.
Yeah, and neither sibling had any psychological issues.
No, nothing that we know of.
Right.
I mean, we all have some issues, but nothing that was okay. Remarkable, you know?
Yeah. So Dodd was charged with first-degree murder in the deaths of the Neer brothers and Lee Iselli, as well as attempted kidnapping of a child for the boy at the theater. During his trial, the prosecution shared excerpts from his diary and showed the photos of little Lee Iselli. The defense had no witnesses or evidence, but they claimed that Dodd was legally insane. Now, he pled not guilty at first by reason of insanity, I guess, but changed his plea to guilty. Prosecutors wanted the death penalty, and jurors agreed. And Dodd agreed that he should die by hanging, and he did not appeal his sentence.
So that's a little unusual. Almost everybody appeals, and most people don't want the death penalty. But he did seem to realize that he wouldn't ever stop. There was nothing that would stop him.
Well, he's told them that, right?
Yeah.
He said, you can do whatever you do. I'm not going to change. If you release me, I'm going to go out and molest and kill kids.
Yeah, so kind of interesting piece of honesty there.
Right.
It took less than 4 years for him to be executed, which is really fast. He refused to appeal, insisting that he would rape and kill again, and he admitted that he enjoyed the killing. So that just puts chills up my spine. He said in interviews that death would give him relief from his guilt and end his compulsion to reoffend. And he actually wrote a pamphlet on how parents could protect their children from people like him. It was titled When You Meet a Stranger.
So he stated that hanging was his ideal method of death. And he was executed by hanging on January 5, 1993, at Washington State Penitentiary in Walla Walla. By Washington state law, Dodd had to choose the method of his execution. State law gave him two options, lethal injection or hanging.
Yeah, he said he chose hanging because that's the way that he had killed Lee Iselli, which I don't know why he said that. It's just part of his warped mentality for attention or something. But he also requested that his hanging be televised. So there is an aspect there of wanting the attention.
Oh, sure.
They denied that request, thank goodness. So his hanging was the first use of hanging for an execution in the U.S. since 1965. And hanging does seem like kind of an old-fashioned, brutal execution for modern times.
It sure does, doesn't it? I mean, this is in the 90s, so it's like 25, 30 years ago.
Yeah. Which is recent in the big scheme of things.
It sure is. And not a particularly, well, I guess there isn't any good way to execute somebody, is there?
Not really, because even with the lethal injection, there are problems.
Yeah.
Because they don't actually have a medical professional do it because of the Hippocratic Oath.
We've talked about all the botched executions by drugs, and that's not the way to do it. I think shooting.
Firing squad seems to be the best.
Gary Gilmore.
Who's that?
He's a killer in, I think, Utah. Norman Mailer wrote a book about him, Executioner's Song.
Oh, yeah, I've heard of it.
Yeah, and he was shot by firing squad or executed by firing squad.
And when was this? You're talking recently?
No, years ago.
So his execution was witnessed by 12 members of local and regional media, by some prison officials, and representatives of the families of the three victims. Dodd was pronounced dead by the prison doctor and his body was transported to Seattle for autopsy. The King County Medical Examiner found that he had died quickly and probably with very little pain, which is unlike his young, innocent victims.
Yeah, I don't know how you can exactly say that. I mean, I think ideally, if you do a hanging right, you break the neck.
Right.
And that pretty much causes instantaneous death.
Well, I think that's the trick of it, because you don't want to just strangle someone, have them hang there and strangle, because that would be miserable. But that would be more like what Little Lee had endured.
It sure would be.
Yeah.
So in addition to being the first execution by hanging in nearly three decades, the Dodd case stands out as a moment in a very particular time period that was marked by heightened awareness of sexual violence. The term sexual predator wasn't really used until the 80s and 90s. Dodd's crimes were part of that change. Then we have the well-known cases of Adam Walsh in 1981, Johnny Gosch in 1982, Jacob Wetterling in 1989, and Polly Klass in 1993.
Well, then there was 7-year-old Megan Kanka. She was murdered by a neighbor who was a convicted sex offender in 1994. And her murder is what led to the federal Megan's Law in 1996. This provided for the public dissemination of information from sex offender registries, such as notifying people when an offender moves into a community. But there's a lot of problems with that. It sounds good, but I don't know how helpful it really is. And unfortunately, there is some information out there that sex offender registries might even do more harm than good. The vast majority of sex offenses are committed by, you know, trusted adults, family members, people that the kid knows, friends, even clergy, and they go unreported because of the manipulation of the victims. Also by poor decisions by other adults, like not wanting to deal with it, cover it up, deny it.
Sure.
And we really saw this when lawsuits uncovered that the Catholic Church hierarchy had hidden and ignored countless cases of child sexual abuse, and that went on for decades. They chose to protect their reputation over protecting the children in their care. And unfortunately, this happens in families even more frequently. The cover-ups.
Oh, it does.
The denial, yeah.
I mean, I had a teenager once, years ago, who told me that he was interested in little kids in a sexual way.
And was he upset about it?
He was.
I don't think anyone chooses to be that way.
Well, I met with him and his parents, and we discussed what the kid had told me, and I recommended counseling because that was about all I had, which, while the parents were thinking that might be helpful, they were also worried about what would happen to their reputation.
Oh,
you know?
Yeah.
And that's what the problem is.
I could see that's a problem, yeah.
And not just for this, but any form of mental illness.
Yes, but this is like one of the most, you know, for lack of a better word, disdained things. I mean, who's more hated than a child sex offender?
Well, I know.
Nobody, really.
Right. They're in prisons. What are they, the lowest of the low on the totem pole?
Yeah, I think they're looked on as the very worst of the worst.
Yeah.
So I could see if you realize that you have that desire, it'd be terrifying and just horrible.
Yeah, it would be. I mean, if I had those thoughts when I was a teen or young adult, first it would scare the hell out of me.
Yeah, yeah.
And then I'd wonder, well, what should I do? If I talk to somebody, I'm going to be shunned or worse. So it's just a really difficult thing.
Well, it is. And it really surprised me when I read that Most pedophiles don't act on it. The majority of pedophiles do not act on it and sexually offend.
So they look at pictures?
Well, I don't know the details. I mean, I don't think that's a good thing either, of course. The pictures are coming from children that are harmed, usually. If you're talking about child pornography.
True. So, but then you got to go after the people that are doing the photography.
Exactly. Yeah, I guess. I mean, it's just a tough subject any way you look at it.
It is.
I'm trying to look at it objectively, but I know that it just makes people feel it's just cringeworthy.
Well, it is.
But I think it's an important thing to talk about because we definitely need more research done on this.
Yeah, I don't know how much more we're going to discuss this, but right now there isn't much to do.
Yeah, we're going to go over that.
Yeah. Now, the biggest thing, the most common type of sex crime often goes unreported. So most sex offenders never become part of the criminal justice system. And they're not affected by Megan's Law or her banishment zone laws. Though in fact, the laws actually might give the public a false sense of security, letting us believe that sex offenders have been exiled from our neighborhoods, or that if a sex offender does live nearby, we'll be notified.
Sure, yeah.
Yeah, if you believe that, you're fooling yourself. And even worse, you're doing your children a disservice.
Absolutely.
Because sex offenders live in every American community, and children need supervision, no matter what.
Well, yeah, like I said, it's unfortunate but true that you do have to supervise your children and be so careful who you even leave them with.
For sure.
And, I mean, you could have someone in your neighborhood who's molested children but never been caught. Or there could be a sex offender who's banished that was, you know, 19 or 20 and had sex with a 16-year-old. So the whole system is pretty fucked up.
Well, that's a little different. I mean, yes, you might be labeled a sex offender, but you're guilty of what? Statutory rape. That's not pedophilia.
Well, that's my point, is that the sex offender list is inaccurate. Because someone like that could be on the list when they're really not a danger to your children. And people who are a danger to your children might not be recognized. Yeah,
right.
They wouldn't be on the
list. So I think the most concerning thing about these banishment zone laws is that they can force sexual offenders to move from environments where they may have family or other support into communities where there's no support. And people who are labeled sex offenders actually lose their jobs, get evicted, sometimes threatened with death, harassment by their neighbors. Coping with this kind of stress is almost impossible. And without exceptionally strong support systems, most are doomed to fail.
Well, I mean, I'm pointing out the obvious. Probably most of us don't feel like we care about the stress or the suffering of a sex offender. But I think we do need to consider the consequences, if not for them, for the rest of society, when the sex offender fails. When nothing works out in their lives, offenders are more likely to give up and reoffend. And unfortunately, that's a fact.
We've moved from pedophiles to sex offenders, and I know they're not synonymous with each other.
No, but they're not mutually exclusive either.
No.
And with Dodd, it's definitely a thing. There's a connection.
Yes.
Yes.
I mean, in his case, he's a pedophile sex offender.
Right.
But I'm certainly more worried about him or his type than about the proverbial 20-year-old sleeping with a 16-year-old.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, my only reason for bringing up that was to show that the list of sex offenders is not going to protect you because it's not going to pick out the people that you really need to be afraid of necessarily.
No, you're painting everybody with a pretty broad brush.
And I think there are some levels that they have too, but still, I really think it's important what you said about a false sense of security. You can't have that. So a 2018 article I read from the ACLU said that rather than banishing sex offenders and asking them to succeed in a hostile environment, we should actually focus on resources, programs, and policies that will actually reduce the likelihood of sex offenses occurring in the first place. So we need to develop and fund public education programs to teach about the effects of sex abuse, as well as the importance of reporting abuse, which is, you know, very rarely done, really, so that it can be stopped. So there's no simple answer here to this devastating problem. Instead of doing things that make no difference or might make children less safe, it would be better if we could find ways of addressing the problem and if we could find ways that actually work.
Well, that's the tricky part, isn't it?
That's the only way to really save potential victims. So the issue is not whether children should be protected. We know that. But what actually does work to protect children? Now, do you have an opinion on that?
How to do that?
Yes. Yes.
Well, sure, there's some things, but it's not enough. I mean, the easy stuff, supervise your kid all the time.
Right.
Either you or someone you trust, educate your kids. According to the Orange County Rape Crisis Center, children need to know their rights, how to identify a dangerous situation, and what to do to get out of a situation. Now, that's all well and good, but it doesn't work that way all the time.
Not all the time, but when I just think about Billy and Cole Near, I feel like some education might have helped them get out of that situation. Because once you're alone with a sexual predator like that, it's too late. He's stronger than they are.
Well, and then look at the kid in the movie theater.
Right. So when we think of Billy and Cole, they obeyed what Wesley Allen Dodd told them to do. Maybe just because he was an adult. I don't know. Maybe they weren't really educated about, you know, stranger danger, which I think was around in the 90s. But they weren't supervised by an adult. But there also might have been some ways that they could have saved themselves if they knew how much danger they were in, or if they felt more empowered.
Yeah, now the little kid at the movie theater did save himself by fighting and screaming.
He absolutely did.
But he also had adults around.
Right. Yeah, but the other boys passed by some teenagers.
Yeah, they didn't say anything.
Which is close to adults. Right. Yeah. But if that boy in the theater had listened to Dodd and complied, he definitely would have been raped and killed, tortured, God knows what.
No question.
He came so close. But I think the foundation of teaching kids to be safe begins with, your body belongs to you. That's what most experts on the topic say. They need to know that they do have the right to say no. That's very basic. But kids don't always feel like they, you know, have possession of their own self, because they're used to being told what to do. I think another thing is to know the correct names for their private parts, so they don't feel ashamed and they feel like it's easier to report inappropriate touching if it does happen. But, you know, in order to have that happen, you need to have parents who are going to listen to them and believe them.
Boy, that's a key thing.
Isn't it? Well, those parents that you talked to about the kid who thought that he had feelings like a pedophile, I'm surprised that they weren't in denial.
Well, I think they were.
You do?
Definitely.
But they did agree to the counseling.
They did. And as far as I know, the kid never molested anybody.
Well, as far as you know, means nothing, though. How would you know?
I mean, he could have and gotten away with it, or could have and it was reported, but he got probation or mental health counseling. Who knows?
Who knows what happened? Yeah. But I think it must be kind of exceptional for a kid to tell his doctor about that. That's brutal honesty. He must have really trusted you.
Well, we had a good rapport.
Yeah.
We did.
Mm-hmm. So if approached by someone, kids need to know that they need to get away quickly and go to a safe place. And they need to know it's not okay for a grown-up to ask them to keep a secret. Predators use secrets to make children feel guilty, or they use threats to get them to keep secrets. So I think it's important to let them know that they never need to keep a secret from their parents. Which, of course, gets much tougher when you get towards adolescence. Because they kind of need to have some secrets.
They do. But there's secrets and there's secrets.
Right. So as they get older, you need to really expand on that education.
Well, yeah. And you got to have open communication.
Yeah.
Many times predators use a process of grooming kids leading up to abuse or even abduction and murder. So this includes people children might communicate with on the internet. So it's crucial that your child can talk to you and you know what's going on in their lives. Certainly, as you said, this gets tougher in adolescence.
Well, yeah, that one recent and terrifying example that comes to my mind is the story of teenager Kaylee Harwood. This was pretty recent, 2015. Kaylee was 14, and she told her parents she was staying with a girlfriend and instead went to meet this 28-year-old man she met on Facebook. She and this man had exchanged over 2,600 Facebook messages. And Kaylee ended up being held captive by him as well as his neighbor before they brutally raped and killed her. So it's really hard to prevent that kind of thing because teenagers feel like they need to break away from their parents And this often involves some secrecy.
Right.
But so, social media is just makes it really tough.
Oh, it's a difficult challenge, isn't it?
I really think you need to have access to your child's account, you know, if at all possible. Although they can always open another account. I mean, they can be sneaky.
Well, they can always stay a step ahead of you, right?
Right.
So according to a recent research from Harvard Public Health, pedophilia, which is defined as the sexual attraction to children who have not yet reached puberty, remains a challenge for clinicians. Researchers have found there's no effective treatment. Like any sexual orientation, pedophilia is unlikely to change. And the goal of treatment is to prevent them from acting on the urges. So either decrease the sexual arousal around children or increase the ability to manage that arousal. The problem is neither is as effective for reducing harm as preventing access to children or closely supervising them.
Right. So I know you kind of had a problem. We talked about this in referring to pedophilia as sexual orientation. But that doesn't mean that it's okay.
Yeah, I agree.
But it is a mental illness. It's in the DSM, right?
It is. And treatment's effective only if a patient with pedophilia is motivated and committed to controlling his behavior.
So that's not going to help us with criminals who want to go out and murder children.
That's not going to help us at all. And outcomes obviously are better when treatment combines both psychotherapy and medication.
And that seems to be true with most mental illnesses.
Sure.
Most psychotherapies used to treat pedophilia use cognitive behavioral therapy. So the focus of this therapy is to enable the patient to recognize and overcome rationalizations about the behavior. The most common type of cognitive behavioral therapy used with sex offenders is known as relapse prevention, and this is based on addiction treatment. Relapse prevention is meant to help anticipate situations that increase the risk of sexually abusing or assaulting a child, and to find ways to avoid or more productively respond to them. So some studies have concluded early on that relapse prevention programs did reduce recidivism. But when you look at an average of 8 years, there's no significant difference in recidivism between sex offenders who underwent relapse prevention therapy and those who didn't have any treatment. So that's kind of a dead end.
So you get to a point where it's not going to help at all.
Yeah.
So then there's aversive conditioning. And this is a behavioral method associating a pedophilic desire with unpleasant sensations, nausea, electric shock, bad smells. This was once popular.
Like the Clockwork Orange.
Right. But a 2010 review concluded that aversive conditioning might increase someone's ability to control sexual attraction to children in the short term, but absolutely no evidence that it worked long term. And that's the whole difficulty with aversive conditioning anyway. Pretty good short term. Fails miserably long term.
Right, right. Well, what about drug treatment? What do we know about that? They have drugs that suppress production of testosterone. What does that do?
Well, that's going to reduce the frequency or intensity of sexual desire.
So why doesn't that just cure them?
What you already said. It's a mental illness.
Yeah, but if you don't have testosterone, how can you have that sexual urge?
You still can. I mean, you might not be able to get the erection that you once had.
Right.
But you still got the urges.
Okay.
There's physical castration.
Which a lot of people, that's their easy answer. Just castrate the fuckers.
Yeah.
What about that? Still doesn't totally work.
No, it doesn't. Testosterone suppression offers advantages, like the need for follow-up visits, which helps professionals monitor behavior. So that's a little bit more desirable, because again, you're getting back into the behavioral therapy plus medication. And if you castrate them, you're going to lose out on being able to follow them along, or possibly follow them along.
Sure. Well, investigators were once really optimistic about the potential for SSRIs, selective serotonin reuptake inhibitors, to treat pedophilia. But this hasn't been proven in randomized trials either. Still, there is the belief that SSRIs may be useful in addition to other treatments, because they don't only subdue sexual drive and urges, but they also help with impulse control in general.
Yeah, but they haven't really proven to be very useful.
No, and there hasn't been enough research really on the combination of things. Like if you castrate someone, put them on SSRIs, and have them in cognitive behavioral therapy, still, that's not foolproof.
Well, how about putting them in jail forever?
That's another thing, yep. So education is important, and I think we need to keep working on treatment, though. But what really strikes us with the case of Wesley Allen Dodd is how he offended by molesting children multiple times and was not put in jail for good, not even for a very long time. So let's talk about the laws. Have they improved since the 90s? Because I think we feel like we're in a better place now than then, or don't we?
I don't.
No.
But they keep making laws.
Right.
So some jurisdictions commit certain types of dangerous sex offenders to state-run detention facilities, following the completion of the sentence if that person has a mental abnormality, I'll put that in quotation marks, or personality disorder that makes the person likely to repeat sexual offenses. So that's one thing, you know, that's the put them in, lock them up.
Right. So in the U.S., 20 states, the federal government, and the District of Columbia have a version of these commitment laws. And these are referred to as sexually violent predator laws or sexually dangerous person laws. But this is controversial because it can be seen as double jeopardy to confine someone after he has served his sentence. And I don't know if this would have stopped Dodd. He seemed to know how to play along with therapists and then go right back to victimizing children.
Well, yeah, some people are smart enough to work the system.
Right, or evil enough that they're never going to stop.
Right.
So I guess the only thing we can do that absolutely works, you're saying, is to supervise our kids.
Yep.
And I really hate to advocate helicopter parenting, but I think at least with young children especially, it's necessary. I mean, Lee Aselli was 4 years old, so he really should have been with an adult. It's kind of shocking to me that someone would let a four-year-old go to the playground with his nine-year-old brother or whatever it was.
Well, that's just, you tell the nine-year-old, watch out for your brother.
That you can't put that on a kid.
You can't do that. Number two, I mean, the nine-year-old's attention span is about 2 seconds anyway.
Right.
It's tough. Yeah, I mean, that's what you got to do. That's something that would be more successful.
Right.
With close continued supervision.
Yep. So there's a book on this case. It's titled Driven to Kill by Gary C. King. And I'd like to recommend it, Dick, but I kind of feel like I can't. For me, it's just too detailed in the crimes that he committed. I mean, it's difficult to even think of the, you know, plain facts of what happened. But to get into the details, you know, the boys begging for their lives, stuff like that, I have to skip that. And I don't really know if anybody wants to read that.
Well, I refused.
Yeah, I know.
So
if we're missing details on the case, it's because we just couldn't read it all. It was upsetting, and I don't think a lot of people want to hear about it. That's why I chose to focus more on possible solutions.
Yeah, and we're not really successful with that either, are we?
Well, we're throwing it out there. We're not going to solve anything on this podcast.
No,
we're just drinking beer and throwing out ideas. That's what we do. And I just hope we get a lot of ideas back from our listeners.
I would love to hear.
They're usually a lot smarter than we are.
Right.
All right, so that does it for that case. I'm going to thank Tristan Capel for writing and producing our music. I'm not going to promote Team Tiegrabber this week because we've had repeated problems with our membership software, and finally we had to make the decision to hire an expert and upgrade everything to a new, better program. So to complete this project, we have to take some days off from accepting new members. But don't despair, I'll be resuming the hard sell in the future episodes. Plus, if you really want the members-only episodes, you can still go to Patreon and become a supporter there and get access to those episodes.
There's a way out.
Yep. So hopefully this new software will make things more seamless and better for our members. But if you do have a few minutes to spare, we would greatly appreciate it if you could leave a review for us on iTunes or wherever you listen. More positive reviews help more people to find our podcast, which is a good thing. So we're going to move on to feedback. If you'd like your voicemail played on a future show, just go to tiegrabber.com and click on Leave a Voicemail. We'd love to hear your comments on cases we've covered or your suggestions for cases that you think we should cover. Alternately, you can send us an email to truecrimebrewery at tygrabber.com. Or just send us a message on Facebook, Instagram, or Twitter. Another thing you might want to do is join our True Crime Brewery fan discussions page on Facebook. And there you can chat with us and other listeners about past cases, case suggestions, or current news in the true crime genre.
Yeah, we've had a lot of action on the Facebook page the last week or so.
And not a lot of voicemails, which makes me a little sad, but lots of emails, which keeps you busy.
Keeps me busy. And the voicemails that we have gotten have been excellent, so you'll hear someone today.
Okay.
But before we get to feedback, I just got one more thing to say. I just want to talk about this company, and I want to tell our listeners about them and how excited I am about them. This is Nativo Condiments and Seasonings. They offer a variety of spice blends of Argentinian heritage, and I guarantee you they will jazz up your meals. Right now there's a half dozen different blends. I've tried them all in a variety of dishes, and I gotta tell you, they really work.
For those who don't know, you're a really big cook and make some great things with these spices.
They are fun to explore. The other thing they do when you get some spices, they offer a recipe of the week, and that gives you specific food and blend recommendations.
Nice.
So go to ArgentineChef.com to explore an order. And for a limited time, enter coupon code NativoShipsFree for free shipping of orders over $10.
Okay.
So we're going to go to feedback.
Mm-hmm.
We have a solitary voice message from Lindsay.
Okay, let's hear it.
Lindsay B.
Hi guys, it's Lindsay from upstate New York. I had two things. One, I just finally joined Team Tygrabber. I decided I'm worth that $3 a month. It's chicken soup for my true crime soul. The only problem is I can't figure out how to access the premium content, and I was wondering if you can touch on that for myself and other future subscribers so we know how the process works. And the other thing I wanted to mention was the case of Dr. William Husell, and I wondered if you guys had a chance to read about it in the media. The Ohio doctor who was recently indicted on 25 counts of murder. And the question that I had is, it kind of sounds like they're mercy killings. I'm not sure if I misinterpreted what I read, but it seems like there were patients who were dying and they gave them lethal doses of fentanyl. I just wondered, with your medical experience, if you had any opinion on that. And thank you guys for everything that you do.
All right. Thanks, Lindsay.
You take the first part.
Okay, so the Team Tygrabber thing, I mentioned a few minutes ago that it's really not working well and we're having it redone, getting new software for membership. So if it's not working for you right now, just send me an email at the truecrimebrewery@tygrabber.com email address and I can try and fix it for you. I might not be able to totally fix it until we get this upgrade done, but that shouldn't take more than a week, so if people can just hang tough and be patient, I think it's going to be worth it to get things to run more smoothly in the future.
There. And the case that Lindsay suggested, William Husell, H-U-S-E-L, is a doctor in Columbus, Ohio, who is an intensive care doctor, an intensivist. And he's been accused, and this is recent. I mean, this is like this month, this year.
Oh, interesting.
He's been accused of killing 25 people by giving them lethal doses of fentanyl, an opiate.
Well, there have been a lot of heroin addicts ODing on that because it's been mixed in the heroin. So
right.
We know it's really deadly.
Well, it's a lot more powerful than morphine and other similar drugs. So
yes.
Now, Lindsay asked one question, was that it seemed to have been mercy killings. I don't think all of them have kind of that label.
Really?
So there are some people that weren't expected to die immediately that were given overdoses.
Well, were there any people who may have recovered?
Don't know.
Okay, so we have to look into that.
The other interesting thing is there's a ton of fallout on this. And what's happened is the hospital has been sued, obviously. But part of their difficulty is that they were aware of the possibilities of this doctor doing things. They didn't immediately suspend him, and it took him a few weeks. And by the time they did get around to taking him off staff, three other patients had died. So
wow.
That's on the hospital.
Which they definitely, they probably could have stopped that.
They could have.
Yeah.
The other thing is that there's a host of people, nurses, pharmacists, and so on, that have been placed on leave with the idea that the Doc Heusel ordered these massive amounts of fentanyl, and nobody said anything about it. The pharmacy filled the orders.
Wow.
The nurses administered the drug.
And, wow.
And the idea is that they knew that they were giving a high dose or a very high dose, but they went ahead and did it anyway.
So he actually killed people by having nurses overdose them?
Yeah, it wasn't always him.
Well, and those nurses should probably lose their license to practice.
Well, this is an interesting case, and I think we're going to want to keep track of it.
I think so.
Because there's going to be a lot of stuff about it.
Yeah, because I think as far as nursing practice, you can't just say, well, that's what was ordered. That's why you're taught about drugs in nursing school.
Well,
so you
yeah.
can decide that's not appropriate.
I mean, us physicians have all had instances where we've ordered something and the nurse says, I can't give this. And when I've checked, it's because I miscalculated
yeah.
the dose or something. But there's a second set of eyes.
Absolutely.
Or a third and fourth. But so, yeah, they went ahead and gave it.
Wow. Okay. That does sound really, really interesting.
Interesting stuff, huh?
Yeah. Fascinating.
Okay, good voicemail, Lindsay. Thank
yes.
you.
Yes, thank you, Lindsay.
Now, we've got some emails. Susan has a comment and a case suggestion. So that's for you, girl.
Okay, Susan writes, thank you for your great podcast. I'm new to listening to podcasts, and I'm completely hooked. With true crime being my favorite genre, and your podcast among my very favorites. My husband likes hearing about your beer recommendations, too. I have a suggestion for a future podcast. It's the unsolved murders of college students Ellen Dooling and Gary Consolino in St. Louis City, Missouri, during November 1980. Here's a blurb from the St. Louis City Police Department's website to give you some background. So, they have the case number, November 1980. Two victims were shot while seated in a blue Oldsmobile Cutlass in the 6200 block of Walsh. Ellen Dooling, an 18-year-old white female, and her boyfriend Gary Casolino, a 20-year-old white male, were discovered outside Dooling's home around 4 a.m. Both victims had been shot in the head. Homicide detectives continue to work this case and urge anyone with information to contact Crime Stoppers. She adds, my husband is a native of St. Louis, and we have lived here for the past 30-plus years. We drive through the neighborhood where this took place almost every day. It's still one of the safest neighborhoods in the city, and I wouldn't be surprised to see some of the neighbors from 1980 are still living there. I've been reading the newspaper accounts and located an article from May 29, 1994, which describes a promising lead from an individual who claims that an acquaintance of his took responsibility for the killings. However, the detectives who interviewed this suspect, who's serving a prison sentence for murder at the time of the interview, could not get a confession from him. There are related articles, however, that law enforcement considered him to be a fairly solid suspect. This case remains unsolved, and I think it has enough mystery and false or maybe not false leads to interest your listeners. Keep up the good work. I just became a member today, so I can listen to your podcast while I clean, wash dishes, sew, chill out, etc. Well, thank you, Susan. I hope that you're able to log in.
Yes.
But just know that I'm working on it if you can't. So what do you think about that? Any comments?
Well, it's an interesting case, and I haven't done too much research on it yet.
But it does seem to have a lot of mystery to it.
Yeah.
Okay, so the next email is from Sue.
Sue has a case suggestion, and this was quite an interesting case. She says, I've become quite a fan of your podcast. I would love to hear what you two could do with the Joan Hill Robinson case. Now, it's actually Joan Robinson Hill. And she was a socialite and equestrian from Houston, Texas. Now, her unexplained death when she was 38 years old led to her husband, John Hill, becoming the first person to be indicted by the state of Texas on the charge of murder by omission. And what that means is that she died as a result of him not getting appropriate care for her.
Oh, I've never heard of that
term. I hadn't either.
Yeah. Okay.
So the case precipitated a series of events that included the 1972 murder of John Hill.
Oh, wow.
Right? And 2 years later, the fatal police shooting of the man accused of Hill's murder. So it's a fascinating case. And we'll have to look some more at it.
Yes. That seems like a very twisted series of events. A murder by omission, do we know what he didn't get help for? Did she stop breathing? Do we have any details on that?
She was likely poisoned.
Oh, which usually is more women that poison than men.
Yeah.
Doesn't mean that a man can't poison, but...
Right. I remember this case because there was a book about it. Tommy Thompson wrote a book called Blood and Money that I'd read years and years ago. This was about that case. Pretty interesting.
So maybe we should read the book and consider covering that case. What do you think?
I think so. I wonder if I still have it. Probably not. I'll look.
Probably not. I think you got rid of a lot of the nonfiction.
I culled a lot when we moved.
Yeah.
And this is a 40-year-old book, so...
Okay.
We'll see.
All right.
Then there's one more. And this is from Sue K.
We got three Sues. A Susan and two Sues.
Yeah.
Okay.
I didn't do that on purpose.
I just want to make sure I'm keeping it straight. That's all.
Sue K. left a message on Facebook, and she just had this old case about a Texas millionaire named Cullen Davis, who was accused and charged and acquitted of the murder of his soon-to-be ex-wife, or was ex-wife's daughter, and the ex-wife's boyfriend, and wounded the wife or ex-wife at the same time. Yeah, it was a shooting. And the ex-wife and another person identified him as the guy who did it, but he got off. He was acquitted. And now, and I haven't seen it, there's a 48 Hours or one of the true crime shows. He decides, Cullen Davis, the guy who was acquitted, decides that he wants to discuss it and profess his innocence some more.
Okay.
So there's something to look up.
Okay. That sounds familiar.
Okay.
Well, thanks a lot. I think we'll wrap it up for today.
It's a wrap.
Okay. All right. Thanks, everybody, for listening, and we'll see you next week at the Quiet End.
Yeah, I still have a little bit more of that beer. See if anybody else wants some more.
I actually really like it.
It's quite good.
It's strong.
Yeah.
But I'm enjoying it.
Okay.
Just the multitude of flavors. And it's viscous.
Right.
Yeah.
Thick.
Yes. Chewy.
See,
as you say.
See those good adjectives?
Yeah, I like
right?
that. Okay. I do like that a lot.
Good beer.
Okay, take care, everyone. Thanks
take it
so
easy,
much
folks.
For listening. Bye.
Goodbye.